Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Malcolm X was gunned down in a Manhattan ballroom in 1965. He told his black followers to stand up for themselves, to be proud, to refuse to turn the other cheek. He became, in life and after, an icon. A new biographer by Manning Marable, who died last week, goes beyond the icon to show us a more complicated leader than the public knew. This hour On Point, the true Malcolm X, his politics, his personal life, his evolution, his assassination. The new biography of Malcolm X out this week is Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. Its author, Manning Marable, himself a big figure in African-American scholarship. Last week, 3 days before the release of his great effort on Malcolm X, Manning Marable died after a long struggle with lung disease of pneumonia. He was already scheduled for interviews that he sadly would not ever be able to make. We will hear in this hour from one of Marable's collaborators, and will be joined in just a moment by Michael Eric Dyson. Let's hear for just a second before we go there from Malcolm X himself. In 1963, African-American journalist Louis Lomax interviewed Malcolm X and asked him if he advocated violence. Here was Malcolm X's response.
The black people in this country have been the victims of violence at the hands of the white man for 400 years. And following the ignorant Negro preachers, we have thought that it was godlike to turn the other cheek to the brute that was brutalizing us. And today, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is showing black people in this country that just as the white man and every other person on this earth has God-given rights, natural rights, civil rights, any kind of rights that you can think of when it comes to defending himself, black people should have, we should have the right to defend ourselves also.
Malcolm X himself, Malcolm X the man. The new biography is Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. Its author, Manning Marable, dead last week at 60, just days before this epic work came out. Joining us now from Washington is Michael Eric Dyson, professor of sociology at Georgetown University, host of public radio's The Michael Eric Dyson Show, a leading African-American scholar often cited as having himself been inspired by Malcolm X. Michael Eric Dyson, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, my friend, for having me.
So begin to pull the covers back on this new biography. You've read it. You know it. You know the life of Malcolm X very well. What are you seeing told here that we don't already know that fills out the picture?
Well, I think that Manning Marable, and rest in peace to that great intellectual giant, did his work in an incredible fashion. And you'll speak later on with Zahir Ali, a brilliant young scholar as well, mm-hmm. who helped Marable with that work in terms of research. But Manning Marable was able to scour every imaginable resource available to us and not available previously to others. For instance, the diaries of Malcolm X, other FBI files, other data that simply no one else has been able to have access to give us a fuller, more nuanced, more colorful portrait of an undeniably important icon in not only African-American culture, but in American society. So what does he talk about? He talks about, for instance, the book that is the autobiography of Malcolm X, written with his amanuensis, his as-told-to partner Alex Haley, himself a great writer. Mm-hmm. But what Manning Marable reveals here is that that book, he says, is more Alex Haley's than it is Malcolm's. Malcolm did not live to see, ironically, in a parallel between Marable's own life, didn't live to see the finished product when it was published. But unlike Marable, he didn't even see the final version that would come forth. And Marable contends that because of Haley's, you know, conservative politics, he was a Republican, maybe a liberal Republican, and because he was deeply invested in integrationist beliefs, the black nationalist element there may have been a bit offensive or out of his trajectory. So
toned down, Malcolm, maybe by Alex.
Toned down a bit. Certain chapters were excised that Manning Marable was able to take a gander at. Gregory Reed, a Detroit attorney, has those chapters that have been excised. Manning Marable was able to determine that they were legitimate and that they were written by Malcolm and that they would have explained the Muslim Mosque Incorporated and the Organization of Afro-American Unity, the two organizations, religious and secular, that Malcolm forged after his time with the Nation of Islam. So he was able to show that the portrait in that autobiography is more Haley's than Malcolm's. The exaggerated details of Malcolm's hustling itinerary have also been dealt with by Manning Marable. And what
hustling
he suggests,
itinerary, you mean his Detroit Red sort of this, criminal days before
all
he
his criminal days
came to
before
Nation
he,
of Islam.
Exactly right. Before he became the vaunted figure and the valued figure that he certainly became after joining the Nation of Islam. But before then, he was a hustler in the streets in New York and the like. And Manning Marable shows that in some instances when Malcolm said he was in New York, he was actually in Lansing, Michigan, not hustling on the streets of New York nearly as dramatically as he had claimed. Now we see that rappers aren't the only people who exaggerate their hustling itineraries for purposes, a variety of purposes. One of the purposes Manning Marable contends Malcolm X exaggerated his hustling background was to prove just how redemptive and how powerful the conversion was from a former street life to the life of the Nation of Islam, a life of disciplined, intellectual, and moral and spiritual recognition of God in oneself and in other black people. So that's there. Also, elements about the domestic life of Malcolm X, how more complicated his relationship was with his beloved wife, Betty, and how they went back and forth and had a lot more vigorous interactions and some domestic intranquility and some dissatisfaction around certain areas. And he deals with that. And so this biography also talks about the time Malcolm spent in Africa and in the Middle East trying to bring America up on charges before the United Nations for its outrageous crimes against African people in America. So Malcolm X is a much more complicated and vibrant figure that Manning Marable fills in. And let me end by saying this. He says that Malcolm X is the greatest figure to emerge within radical black politics and African-American culture in the 20th century. So those who may be put off by some of the unsavory elements that have been talked about in the book miss the broader stroke here, and that is that Malcolm X is such a formidable figure, but he is made greater by examining him in the full context of his human achievement and flaws than he is by idealizing him and making him a perfect icon of African-American struggle.
In saying that, does Marable say that he's greater than Martin Luther King Jr.? Dr.
says he's the most powerful radical figure to emerge within black culture in the 20th century. I think that Manning Marable sees in Malcolm X that for black struggle, he says that Martin Luther King Jr. was a great American figure, but Malcolm X pitched his own ideological framework in the terms that were defined by within dominant white culture, of course, by African-American people as well. But he argues that Malcolm X is the most essential figure to emerge from within the context of African-American culture and to demand black radical politics be at the heart of his trajectory and vision. So, he's claiming that he's the greatest figure in that regard from black America in the 20th century.
If you define it that way, generations now have read the autobiography of Malcolm X. Time magazine called it one of the most important books of the 20th century. Alex Haley, of course, took hours and hours of Malcolm X's description of his life, turned it into this book. So many people have read it, been assigned it in college, you name it. If you go to Amazon.com right now, they call it The Archetypal Journey from Ignorance and Despair to Knowledge and Spiritual Awakening. That's kind of the iconic story structure given to Malcolm X in the autobiography. Is that thrown off the rails by this new biography? Is it still that essential archetypal journey, or does it emerge as something else here, Michael Eric Dyson?
Well, it certainly has to be seen through the prism that Manning Marable has presented in his book. Mm-hmm. It's not that the book will no longer be useful or read, or that people will not turn to it for an iconographical sketch of a black life lived in public trying to come to grips with the vicious forces of white supremacy. That stuff will remain. But I think it's undeniable that what Manning Marable has done here is to show us just how artificial and constructed any memoir or narrative or autobiographical arc is. Even people without the immense responsibilities of Malcolm X or his aide in writing, Alex Haley, even those without those enormous burdens of fame and trying to satisfy the ideological and political demands of a constituency, have to respond to the demands of making a literary shape, giving a literary shape to one's own lived experience. So there are always choices and made and things left out and things put in and exaggerations and, you know, fudgings or sometimes misremembering and the like. That's the normal status, though we applaud those who overcome the impediments and obstacles that they confronted in life to write their stories. We all always know that there are some literary licenses that are sometimes taken much more extreme in other cases than others. So having said that, I think Manning Marable does a brilliant job of showing us that there that autobiographical narrative is not necessarily the life Malcolm lived, and the life Malcolm lived is much more complicated and much more interesting and ultimately, as you indicated in the opening, still compelling. So I think the autobiographical narrative has to be read with a grain of salt, and that grain of salt, or perhaps even a pound, is provided by Manning Marable's magisterial and, you know, work here, his magnum opus.
Being lauded all over the place. We just got 20 seconds before the break. Malcolm X was maybe best of all known for his fierce black pride. Does it come across as any less fierce, any less proud in Manning Marable's telling?
Not at all. Even more so, because Malcolm X was able to grapple with the vicious forces from within the dominant culture as well as some of those elements within his own culture, and still remains an abidingly interesting, intriguing, and great figure.
Michael Eric Dyson joins us this hour to look at the new profile that emerges and detail in the new biography. Himself, author of April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King's Death and How It Changed America, author of Can You Hear Me Now? The Inspiration, Wisdom, and Insight of Michael Eric Dyson. We're going to hear in just a moment from a colleague of Manning Marable who will join us from New York. Michael, I thought we'd listen for another minute here to Malcolm X himself. This is a speech May 22nd, 1962, in Los Angeles, and he was challenging here black Americans, black people, to love themselves.
Who taught you to hate the texture of your hair? Who taught you to hate the color of your skin to such extent that you bleach to get like the white man? Who taught you to hate the shape of your nose and the shape of your lips? Who taught you to hate yourself from the top of your head to the soles of your feet? Who taught you to hate your own kind? Who taught you to hate the race that you belong to? So much so that you don't want to be around each other. No, before you come asking Mr. Muhammad, does he teach hate? You should ask who yourself, who taught you to hate being what God gave you.
Malcolm X, 1962. Let me get just a couple of calls before we bring in Zahir Ali. Hank's calling from Morrisville, Vermont. Hank, thank you. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I believe Malcolm X is a great man. He is a voice for nonviolence. We needed a voice to fight the stock market because I own a bike shop here, and you know, the stock market is starting to affect my prices like gas almost every day, and it's getting nonsense. And I like to, you know, I love hearing about Malcolm X. It's a great topic. And
you say a voice of nonviolence, but he said, you know, if you're pushed far enough, by any means necessary.
Oh, absolutely. But did any violence ever occur from any of that, any of his rallies? No, if anything, you know, the police fought back harder than the protesters did.
Of course, he had his own violent end from the falling out within the Nation of Islam. Hank, thanks for your call. Chauncey, Hampton, Virginia. Chauncey, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi also to Michael Dyson, if he's
indeed
still there.
Yes, he is, very much so.
And remember, we still have the Hampton Jazz Festival. Come back and visit us, Michael.
All right, my friend.
I'm looking forward to reading this book by Professor Marable, and because, especially at this time, especially the number of African-American males of high intelligence who are incarcerated, and I'm very much in need of a reinvention. And I don't think too many people pick up on that.
Certainly there's a very large incarcerated population today. But what does that say to you, Chauncey, that you want a Martin Luther, well, I mean a Malcolm X now to speak to that?
Well, I'm saying that in as much as this book seems to explore his complexity, there's a deeper complexity to some of the African-American males today. And we need to kind of explore that more. And I'm looking at that. I'm looking forward to reading this book and hoping that the example set by Malcolm, who certainly did reinvent himself through continually exploring other avenues, exploring other thoughts, Eastern thought as well as Western thought, and then bringing it back in whatever context was necessary at the moment.
Yeah, I'm sure he would have been speaking about exactly that issue today. I mean, it's hard to doubt that he would. And Chauncey, I appreciate your call. One more here. Richard, Burlington, Vermont. Richard, you're on the air.
I'm just delighted that you're doing this, and I just want to report that when I was younger than I am now, Malcolm X initially sort of frightened me. But then after I found out what he was doing and what he was saying, I embraced him completely. And I also want to say, too, that a second message is that Malcolm's message is still needed in our society, Vermont and U.S., mostly because in Vermont we have a 3% population of people of color, and the population of people in jail is well over that. So something has to be done.
Richard, I appreciate your call as well. Michael Eric Dyson, there's just a taste of people calling in. We'll hear more of that. If I may, I'd like to bring in Zahir Ali. I think Michael.
Yeah, I want to respond to the callers because I think brother Ali in. But I think that the first caller talked about the violence, and I think he's absolutely right that there was no violence manifest in Malcolm's life. It was except against him. And accept the rhetorical violence that he heaped upon the domain of white supremacy. And in his eulogy for Malcolm X, it was Ossie Davis who said, "Did you ever hear or see this man involved in violence? He was our prince. He was our black, shining black manhood." So I think that's very important to mention. And yes, secondly, to the second call, Malcolm X certainly would have addressed the enormous disparity in the incarceration of African-American men and women and Latino men and women, a smaller percentage of the population than the overwhelming and exaggerated numbers of black men and Latino men and women who are in prison. And Malcolm X certainly would have indicted a vicious criminalization of black people who are in mass numbers there for nonviolent drug offenses. And then finally, I think the caller is absolutely right, is that, yes, Malcolm frightened many people, but when they began to understand what he was speaking about, the rage he had toward the formal restrictions and the informal rituals that were imposed upon African-American life, this is why Malcolm X continues to this day to be an iconic figure who represents such powerful strokes of black resistance to those forces that still remain in our society.
I have to say, we'll put this to Zahir Ali. If you simply look at what he said, you can certainly find plenty on violence. He said, "Be peaceful, be courteous, obey the law, respect everyone. But if someone puts his hand on you, send him to the cemetery." He said, "I am for violence if nonviolence means we continue postponing a solution to the American black man's problem just to avoid violence." And he said, "I don't even call it violence when it's in self-defense. I call it intelligence." Well, look at that. Zahir Ali joins us from New York. He worked in the early years with Manning Maribel on Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, former associate director of the Malcolm X Project at Columbia University. He's a doctoral student in history at Columbia. And I should say, by the way, you can read an excerpt of the new biography, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, at our website, onpointradio.org. Zahir Ali, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm deeply honored and humbled to be able to sit in this seat representing Manning Maribel's work. Of course, I would have preferred he be the one sitting in this seat, but I'm thankful to have had the chance to work with him and also to be sharing this program with Dr. Dyson, who actually introduced me to Professor Maribel many years ago, setting me on this path. So it's almost coming full circle as we say goodbye. Dr. Dyson was the one who helped me say hello to Dr. Maribel, and he's here for me to help me say goodbye to him. So thank you both for doing this program.
And you're very welcome. The world goes round and round, and we definitely honor Manning Maribel as we talk about his work right here. I wonder how you're looking at this book as it finally comes out, Zahir. This was a labor of years. Viking and Penguin bringing it out. And, you know, I'm looking here at the letter they sent us to introduce the thing. They say, filled with shocking revelations about the life and death of this iconic American figure. Shocking revelations? What's most shocking to you in this book, Zahir?
Well, you know, I worked with Professor Marable for 4 years as the associate director of the project. And then after that, I worked as his teaching assistant for his Malcolm X class, where he'd workshop these chapters, mm-hmm. early drafts of these chapters. And when you know, talking to Professor Marable at any point in time during this period, there was, you could go in asking him a question about Frederick Douglass and you'd come out talking about Malcolm X. It was so heavy on his mind. And so for me, reading this book is both learning and relearning about Malcolm as much as it is reading echoes of past conversations I had with Dr. Marable. And so it's a chronicle of our work, some of our work together. For me, I think what's most surprising and compelling about this text, in addition to what Dr. Dyson said in terms of giving us a full multidimensional view of Malcolm in his humanity, including the struggles he had as an individual and within his organizations. But for me, what was most compelling was the level of surveillance that he was under. You know, the first page of his FBI file was opened in 1950 while he was still in prison, before he even considered the Nation of Islam, when he wrote a letter to Harry Truman protesting the Korean War. So from very early on, he had attracted the attention of the authorities. And then his first, one of the earliest appearances that Malcolm makes in the FBI files is when, in 1954 of January, he's having a meeting in Boston to begin, you know, he had been traveling to set up these temples for the Nation of Islam, and these meetings would start in small family homes, and maybe 10 or 12 people were at this meeting, and one of them was an informant who reported on it. That gives you a sense of how deeply embedded the FBI was in not just the Nation of Islam, but later in his own organization. And this is, of course, something that he would not be fully aware of, and we don't get in the autobiography. So for me, one of the most shocking things was the level of infiltration by the federal and state in agencies in his affairs. And at one point, you know, they had an informant do a kind of sifting of Malcolm. And they say, you know, he's very moral. He doesn't drink. He doesn't smoke. And essentially, they're trying to find his weakness. I mean, this is the kind of disruption disruptive forces that he was subject to. And I think in moving forward and understanding the struggles he had in starting a new organization after he left the Nation of Islam, and the conflict that developed between he and the Nation of Islam, I think that's an important element. The other thing that I thought was really eye-opening were the travel diaries that Dr. Marable cites to give us a fully fleshed out narrative of Malcolm's time in Africa, the four months he spent.
After he went on the Hajj, this is after he broke the Nation of Islam, but this isn't the Hajj. This is actually over
this
a much broader area of Africa.
That's right. This is the second trip. And you know, most of the autobiography was written by 1963. Alex Haley felt he had enough material to complete the autobiography. And, of course, Malcolm hadn't even left the nation yet. And so this part of Malcolm's life, when he is, after he's left the nation, after he's made Hajj, he's spending a lot of time in Cairo from July 1964. He spends 19 weeks. He's visiting officials of Nasser. He's visiting people from the Muslim Brotherhood. He's taking Islamic studies at Al-Azhar. He's meeting with Akbar Muhammad, Elijah's son, who had left Elijah's movement as well. He's traveling. This is when he's trying to get the Organization of African Unity to condemn the United States for its treatment of African Americans, very much like they had condemned apartheid in South Africa. He goes to Kenya. He addresses the Kenyan parliament. I mean, he meets the who's who of Africa at this time. And this is, you know, Malcolm is reformulating his idea of how black people's struggle relate to the global struggle against racism and for freedom. And I think that was an incredibly eye-opening time for me to examine that part of Malcolm, which we know very little about. And the third thing that we see about that time is his deepening spiritual connection to Islam, and how he was fashioning this kind of Pan-Africanism and also Pan-Islamism, and seeing how the two could help facilitate this anti-racist struggle. And so,
because also a Pan-racialism in a way there for the first time.
Is that fair?
I mean, he found Muslims who were not black, and he said, wait a minute, it doesn't have to be black only.
Well, one of the things he did, and this was interesting, when he writes his letter from Mecca that everyone likes to cite as a kind of vindication of themselves, especially a white America felt like, oh, finally Malcolm has come around. And if you read that letter quite closely, he talks about, you know, sitting with people with the whitest of white skin, blondest of blonde hair, and bluest of blue eyes, but they didn't act white. Right. So he still sees whiteness as something that's problematic. And what is really forward thinking about that letter that I think many people missed was that Malcolm came back from that with a kind of understanding of race as a socially constructed idea, that you could actually be, you know, phenotypically white, but not think white, because he understood that whiteness was an identity that was constructed based on privilege, that was based on the social, political, and economic oppression of non-white people. And he offered with that letter not a vindication, you know, to white America, but a suggestion that maybe if you studied, he said, Islam, but maybe you could deconstruct your connection to that privilege. Maybe you could understand how whiteness is a problem even for you. See, Malcolm was really important, because not only did he talk about what racism had done to black people, but he talked about what racism had done to white people.
Michael Eric Dyson, if I may, as I hear, stand by 1 second. We just got a minute before the break, but do you see a softening in the black nationalism in those last, really only months? I mean, he was dead by 39, maybe a year, but in reading Manning Maribel, what light do you see shown on that particular issue, Michael?
Well, I think it's a broadening of America's conception of what black nationalism is. It was always humane. The whole point of Malcolm's argument against American culture was that it failed to understand that if you want to understand what I am, understand what you are. If you want to know what I'll do, ask yourself what you would do in my condition. American nationalism is the predicate for American pride. We can't get enough books of Benjamin Franklin and Aaron Burr. We can't get enough books about Thomas Jefferson. This is American nationalism writ large against the canopy of American exceptionalism. And Malcolm was simply saying, then understand why African-American people have to argue for the centrality of their pride in defense of their vulnerable humanity as they are assaulted by American nationalism. So black nationalism is a beautiful arc of pride that says, in the face of all kind of domination, we will exist and stay here and still love ourselves.
We're talking about the man who said, I'm for truth, no matter who tells it. I'm for justice, no matter who it's for or against. Halim is calling from White Plains, New York. Halim, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My name is Halim Cruz. I just wanted to point out that, you know, Malcolm X has not only inspired and motivated and emboldened African Americans, but he has also emboldened and ignited a fire in a lot of Afro-Latinos. I am of Puerto Rican descent. I come from three generations of Puerto Rican Muslim converts. And when Malcolm returned from his Hajj, my parents instantaneously gravitated not only towards Malcolm and the African diasporic movement of independence and social empowerment, but they also gravitated towards Islam. And, you know, right now, I mean, New York Times reported late January that there is a new phenomenon of Latino converts. I think they quoted the number at close to 200,000 of Puerto Rican, Dominican, Cuban, and other Afro-Latinos who are finding a new voice in Islam, as well as through the through their social contacts within the African American community, and also from reading the autobiography of Malcolm X. Two other things I'd like to point out: Professor Henry Louis Gates is coming out with a PBS documentary on Black in America, and he points out in his documentary that of the 15 million slaves that were imported from Africa to the New World, only about 500,000 were transported to the U.S., and the other 14.5 million were sent to south of Miami. And so this is, you know, it's
Latino country.
Exactly, Latino, every Central America, South America, Dominican Republic, Cuba. We're finding out now that the first major slave revolt was in the Dominican Republic by the Wolof Muslims, and who many and so this is, my wife is Dominican, and this is all this information in history has emboldened us. And it's not necessarily to you know, indoctrinate or proselytize Islam, because I don't think that's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what is necessary is that Malcolm's voice is still alive, and it's now awakening the Latino community the same way how it has moved in the African-American community. It's doing that on another level.
Halim, we hear your passion for it right there, and I'm very glad for that call. Let me hold that right there, if I may, and get one more call here. Savannah, Georgia, Elizabeth. Halim, thank you. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, gentlemen. I have a question. I am of the age growing up and going to school in the 70s that Martin Luther King and Gandhi were the models that we should all try to emulate.
Yeah.
They were the leaders. And Malcolm X and Louis Farrakhan were an anathema to what our teachers and our parents wanted us to follow. Now, in the last decade, I have heard more and more about Malcolm X, and I am wondering where this comes in, as now that he is someone that we want to not necessarily emulate, but certainly pay more attention to what he has written and what he has lived through. When did that occur?
Elizabeth, let us pick it straight up. It's a great question. And Halim, thanks to you as well. Again, Michael Eric Dyson, what about that? We're hearing, I mean, today there's a kind of truth-telling, also lionizing of Malcolm X that's gone on for a long time. You know, are these mutually exclusive? Respect for Dr. King and his message of nonviolence, respect for Malcolm X and his more assertive message? And what about the relative standing of these two figures?
Well, first of all, I think we have to be honest. We weren't respecting Dr. King's message to begin with. Dr. King was seen as one of the most venomous embodiments of black resistance that had to be reviled before the rise of Malcolm X. When Malcolm X rose in American culture, then Dr. King's edges were softened. And I think, unfortunately, people then relegated him to the margins as a non-revolutionary figure when King was equally as vigorous in his revolutionary intent, working within the confines of American society and within the logic of American integrationism. Malcolm X was arguing from a point outside of this Archimedean conception of democracy. That is, somebody standing out there saying America's great, it's a great nation, it's an exceptional nation.
That's a pretty different vantage point.
It must be the moral police person of the world.
That's a pretty different vantage.
It's a tremendous advantage and disadvantage, right? Because when you're outside, you don't have to, lie. You don't have to try to convince the dominant culture that what you're saying is reasonable. You can just tell the truth based upon your perspective.
Are you saying Martin Luther King was lying?
No, I'm not saying Martin Luther King was lying. Martin Luther King had to deal with how to convince white America to go against its own perceived self-interest in deference to a broader conception of democracy. So Martin Luther King Jr. had to pacify white America to a certain degree. If you read David Garrell's book, he talks about the shift in King before 1965 and after 1965. And before 1965, he tried to appeal to the moral conscience of white America. After that, he began to tell a bolder truth in harsher stroke to say that, look, most Americans are unconscious racists. Most of America is incapable of acknowledging the truth of black suffering. And as a result of that, we have to become much more aggressive. That's the King that most people obscure. So they create a gulf between what King was saying and what Malcolm X was saying. I'm not suggesting that there was no gulf, because there certainly was. But I'm simply saying that when you say we were taught to appreciate Dr. King. Put that in perspective. You were taught to appreciate Dr. King after he was dead. You were taught to appreciate Martin Luther King Jr. after he was in the grave and he was no longer a threat to the forces of dominant American society. So he has been lionized and iconized in his own death. Malcolm X was demonized while he lived.
With respect, that may be true in broad stroke. But I can speak personally that I grew up. Martin Luther King was alive and respected in the white community in which I lived. I mean,
I'm not denying that there were no white people who respected Martin Luther King Jr. I'm saying, in broad stroke, Martin Luther King Jr. If you look at Taylor Branch's book, if you look at my book, if you look at David Garrell's book, there is enormous discussion about, for the first time in 10 years, in 1967, Martin Luther King Jr. was no longer on the 10 most admired Americans list. Martin Luther King Jr. could barely get a speaking engagement in a university. No American publisher wanted to publish his book. He was at the low point of his popularity because of his stand against Vietnam. He was stripped of his PhD in the press. They no longer called him a Nobel Prize winning person. They no longer referred to him as Dr. King. So when you look at the broad stroke, I'm not suggesting that individual white people didn't, and broad significant segments of white America didn't appreciate Dr. King, but they appreciated the pacifying Dr. King, not the more radical King at the end of his life. And as a result of that, the real Martin Luther King Jr. was not really and profoundly appreciated. And we know that the hunt for him was real. And when he died, broad segments of white America celebrated, had parties, and felt it was a triumph that King was no longer there. Well, so that's all I'm trying to say. I'm not trying to demonize white America in that regard.
Manning Marable himself, writing an introduction to the new biography, says, King presented a narrative to white Americans that suggested that Negroes were prepared to protest nonviolently and even die to realize the promise of the nation's founding fathers. Right. Manning Marable writes, by contrast, Malcolm X, proposed that the oppressed had a natural right to armed self-defense. Got lots of questions and comments online here. Zahir, here's one from Donald Baxter talking about Malcolm X. He says, great man. His sexism and homophobia, though, could not be overstated, our listener Donald writes. If he had lived, I have to wonder how he would have evolved on these issues, or if, is the question that Donald raises. Here's another listener writes, as a gay man, I'm very much hoping you would speak of Malcolm X's, quote, early homosexual relationship with a white businessman. They're quoting from reports of Manning's book, as reported by the New York Times. LGBT history is very limited, and I would love to learn as much as I can regarding this. This goes back to that hustling time, as Professor Maribel's written here, as you well knows it here, and the idea that there's a kind of fictionalized version of gay interaction in the autobiography of Malcolm X. Manning Marable says it's more likely that that was Malcolm X himself during this period working for a white businessman in Boston.
Right. That characterization is somewhat correct. But before I get into that, I want to say one of the reasons why Malcolm has become increasingly popular is because African American scholars especially have taken greater control over the telling of our history and rescuing these historical figures and movements from caricature. And so this book is an attempt to do that. And to the earlier caller about Malcolm's growing influence amongst people outside the African American community, when he was abroad, he met with revolutionaries in Algeria who said to him, you know, am I part of your revolution because I look white? And he came back deeply affected by that and began to articulate not a narrow nationalism. He was always a champion of black self-determination, but it was always in the context of a global Pan-African anti-racist perspective. And I wanted to point that out because when he came back from his travel, he met with people like Yuri Kuchiyama, who was a Japanese activist, and he created spaces for non-African Americans to participate in the freedom movement. In terms of this question about Malcolm's early relationships before he went to prison, I think Professor Marable, you know, in seeking to do this comprehensive biography, he was, as a historian, this is not an ideological text. Mm-hmm. It is an empirical text. And he had to take into account every piece of evidence, as Dr. Dyson said, that he scoured the earth for, literally. And so for him to write the story of Malcolm, he could not exclude what other scholars had brought up before. Bruce Perry raised this issue in 1992 in Malcolm, A Life of a Man Who Changed Black America. And so In the portrayal, I think it's important to point out that in the discussion of this issue, Professor Marable says that this is circumstantial but strong evidence. And mm-hmm. then he tries to piece together, based on narratives of Rodnell Collins, who was the nephew of Malcolm, the son of Ella Collins, where Malcolm stayed in Boston during his Detroit Red days. So he's drawing from that. He's drawing from Malcolm's autobiography. He's drawing from letters that Malcolm wrote to his siblings and about this gentleman who said he would vouch for him to the parole board, offering him a house and a home.
May I
and
read from Manning Marable himself?
Yeah.
He writes, sometime in 1944, Malcolm had begun working for Lennon. That's Paul Lennon. Mm-hmm. As a, quote, butler and occasional houseworker at Lennon's Boston home on an affluent stretch of Arlington Street overlooking the public garden. Soon, Marable writes, something deeper than employer-employee relationship developed. Of course, in the autobiography of Malcolm X with Alex Haley, Manning Marable writes, that describes sexual contacts with Lennon, except that Malcolm falsely attributed them to a character named Rudy. Mm-hmm. And then he goes on to write, based, as you say, on circumstantial but strong right. evidence, Malcolm was probably describing his own homosexual encounters with right. Paul Lennon. What about our listener's question there? You know, he says Malcolm X, great man, but sexism and homophobia, part of the fabric as well. Does the biography speak to how Malcolm X himself, you know, dealt with the complexity that he knew from his own direct experience here?
Well, I do think a couple of things. He goes on to say, you know, that this experience was limited. But I just mm-hmm, want to say yes. more broadly, mm-hmm. I don't, and I've said this to my students when we discuss this, and they are, you know, this is something that they have trouble dealing with. And we want to say, I want to make clear that for Professor Marable, discussing the possible homosexual relationship of Malcolm X to another man is not an insult. And I think
it's
when people
life.
Take it as an insult, that has to do with our own kind of homophobia that we have to check. You know, mm-hmm. I think a lot of the reactions to this text are more indicative of our own homophobia than the text itself. So that being said, you know, Malcolm came up in a very patriarchal society, which was compounded, obviously, when he was in the Nation of Islam. And so this was partly responsible for some of the difficulties he had in his marriage. You know,
kind of alienation from Betty Shabazz, not as much intimacy as you might have thought there, Manning Marable describes.
Yeah, so I think as Malcolm developed and as he evolved, when he formed the OAAU, the Organization of Afro-American Unity, there were women who were who took on strong leadership positions, and he began to kind of make spaces for women to share in leadership and move beyond the notion of the kind of the rhetoric of protection that would guarantee women the protection that they had been denied or had not been able to receive, you know, as victims or targets of white racism, but not a protection that confined them to certain spaces, domestic spaces mm-hmm. that, you know, would be the kind of trade-off. Like, we'll be protected if you dress a certain way, or you'll be protected if you stay in a certain
right.
space. Malcolm was moving beyond that. Of course, his life was cut short at age 39, and I don't think if you were to survey most of his peers, you would find many of them had difficulty dealing with these same issues.
So here, let me take it, yeah. if I may, to Michael Eric Dyson for a moment. Our time grows short. We could fill hours with this, but it's interesting. Zahir Ali says there he was moving. Manning Marable describes him moving throughout his life. Reinvention is right there in the title. I mean, from right. the arc, you've read this, Michael, from the arc of his life and thinking that you see here, is it possible to project forward where Malcolm X was headed when his life was cut short at 39? In what direction, what sort of sense of the world, race relations, the black place in that world? Do you have a sense of where the further evolution of the arc of his reinvention may have been heading?
Well, yeah, it's always dangerous to speculate
yes,
based upon the information we have. But having said that, I think that obviously Malcolm X was a profound internationalist. He saw the global dimensions of struggle against oppression. We didn't even get a chance to address what the Latino brother caller called in, mm-hmm. which was so right mm-hmm. about the numbers of slaves
yes.
who were taken to Latino cultures in Caribbean cultures and the like. And talking about how Malcolm X was a global figure who influenced not only African-American people, but Latinos throughout the world, which is always interesting to me when we talk about Latinos being the biggest part, the biggest minority in America now, the African dimensions of Latino culture are often obscured, but that's another conversation. So yes, Malcolm would have evolved, I think, into a global internationalist who was concerned about human rights wherever people are subject to injustice. So in that sense, when King said injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, Malcolm X says, I'm for justice wherever it is and for human beings who are against whose backs are against the wall wherever they are. So in that sense, his broad ideological trajectory was toward human rights, global recognition of the struggle against oppression, and all human beings in ultimate solidarity.
It is an endlessly fascinating story, which we had time for more today. This new book takes us a big step forward. Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. Michael Eric Dyson, Zahir Ali, our deep thanks to each of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.